Recording. Okay, welcome to the latest episode of Inspiring Futures. I'm delighted that Craig and Bridget of Craig and Bridget are joining me from London, I believe. Is it London?
Yeah, we're in London.
They're very glamorous HQ. And we were just saying that last time we chatted with a couple of years ago, and they were kind of working from home now. Things have moved along. So welcome to the podcast. And maybe you should just, Bridget, do you want to start and just introduce yourself a little bit? Some people might not have listened to the podcast 2 years ago, and just tell us a little bit through your background and why you are where you are.
Yeah. Hello, everyone. I'm Bridget. I have spent quite a few decades working in advertising, started at J. Walter Thompson, then met Craig at Abbott Midlicker's BBDO, where we ran the strategy department together for over 15 years. And then for the last 2.5 years, we have been running our own brand strategy consultancy.
Great. Craig.
I have a mirror set of experiences, really. And I think it's been just a great shift, I guess, from having worked at the kind of, you know, at the peak, I would say, of kind of network agencies and what that meant. And now having spent a couple of years in the independent sector doing our own thing. I mean, we'll come on to talk about it, but it feels like the world has opened up a little bit in many different ways. But we'll come on and chat about that as we go. But yeah, we're having a good time at the moment.
That's great. What's been the biggest lesson or the biggest learning that you guys have gained from, you know, leaving Adland and setting up on your own? Maybe what's the biggest challenge been that you maybe surprised you the most?
We're extraordinarily privileged, let's say that to begin with. And I would say I can't think of a challenge that we've faced so much. I think the only challenge we have are the day-to-day challenges of how can you continue to come up with ideas that you consider to be good enough and that your clients think are amazing. And we set ourselves extraordinarily high standards in that respect. So I think those are the challenges. In terms of, you know, surprises and things we've discovered, I think the main one for me is the absolute value of independence in its own right. And I mean that in the broadest sense. So running your own company, giving you the opportunity to make whatever decisions you want to make on a daily basis about what you do, what you don't do, what you charge, what you don't charge, who you work with, who you don't work with, all that stuff. And then in addition, independence from a structure that largely sort of incentivizes you to make decisions and make business that helps the other people in your structure, as opposed to making decisions that are just about what's the right thing for the client in front of you and the job they've given you. And that pure independence has so much value. It probably has monetary value. It certainly has like mental health value. It has life value. And as I say, we're extraordinarily privileged to have been in a position to be able to exercise that independence and to have had the platform we did. But I never thought independence per se would be such an important thing and such a valuable thing.
Yeah, I think mine is similar. I've been surprised, I suppose, by the extraordinary talent that exists as soon as you step out of the structures of big organizations. We've been lucky enough to work with some brilliant people, and that's been a real delight. And the hard bit is being good every day. There's no downtime. You know, we keep describing what we do now as a distillation process of everything we did before, but it's intense because we're constantly spending our time trying to solve clients' problems in an interesting and, you know, distinct way. And that's quite tiring.
Yeah, it's funny how what a small percentage of the time we spent in our old jobs was actually about strategy versus general management of the agency or management of people, all of which are important things, or just sitting in meetings that you didn't really need to be in. And we don't do any of that anymore. It's to use a metaphor we've used a couple of times, our job is now like all bricks and no mortar. It's like it's just the stuff. It's the coming up with the ideas, it's the doing the research to come up with the ideas, and then it's communicating the ideas, and there's nothing else, which, as Bridget says, means we're basically on from the moment we start in the morning to the moment we stop in the afternoon, and there's no downtime in the middle.
I sometimes just crave those meetings we sat in where we were discussing the furnishings or something else around the agency.
Yeah, yeah. just for a little break.
Yeah. Yeah, in some ways there was a lot of fat, you know, the luxury of a lot of wasted hours and time. And now you've got to be super productive.
Exactly right.
Another thing I got a lot of response to. I posted something on LinkedIn about the idea of a strategy team. And people seem to love the idea, but they can't get their heads around how the hell they would make it work.
I mean, we have thoughts on that. Yeah. I saw your post and I thought it was great. I mean, I think there is one of the things we discovered, right, which I don't think we knew when we last spoke with you, is that we had never actually worked together before, right? So we'd worked together in the sense that we were running the department and we did a lot of people management together and we did a lot of agency strategy stuff together. But the clients usually only knew one or the other of us. We hadn't worked together on ideas. Mm-hmm. And that was such a different process because we're constantly kind of pushing and testing one another's ideas. Mm-hmm. And it makes them better overall. We do better work together than either one of us would have done individually. And as you say, that's because we're a strategy team and that's how it works. I mean, I think in terms of how do you make it work, we get through so much more stuff because we are a team and we share and collaborate. And so we get to better ideas faster by spending time together. And again, if you're stuck in a system whereby you're meant to be billing hours against a certain client and you can't quite work out, you know, whether or not you've put in the right number of hours, then it misaligns the incentive somewhat. Whereas when you're in a system where the only thing that matters is the quality of the ideas, then you work differently.
There's some soft skills I think required too, which it requires a sort of radical honesty with each other, but not taking things personally when Craig says to me that's crap or vice versa. You know, you have to trust each other that you're not going to, I don't know, fall out over it, that the task you're trying to solve is the thing that you're disagreeing about, not with each other. And that's a skill.
We've worked with collaborators on occasion as we've gone through, and we still do, but what you sometimes find in comparison to working with one another is that your views on the ideas you're being presented with, suddenly you start yourself thinking about their motivations and how are they going to feel, and, oh, I don't want to discourage them, and they've been nice to come out here and help us out, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And of course, what happens is, without you really intending to or even knowing you're doing it, is you just become a little softer on the ideas. Whereas when we do it together, because of what Bridget says, because we don't really think about one another's feelings, maybe we should do more, we're just attacking the ideas and you know, knocking them into shape. And there's never a moment where we think, oh, I can't say that because maybe they'll be offended. And that has a huge value, again, because it just makes the ideas so much better.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting that it's about that relationship, right? You know, it's about the trust and the relationship, which seems to come up time and time again in terms of what makes effective work and effective workplaces.
Yeah,
psychological safety is the technical term. Yeah. But yeah, you do so much better work. What about, I always find it interesting, as you know, doing the same kind of work as you guys do, a little bit, probably not at the same level, but you know, just writing strategies, or you know, just getting to the point. I think there's a lot of criticism inside client organizations and agencies, which is sort of, I wish they'd take the strategy further. Like this, they've given me a deck and now I've got to do something with it. And it seemed really fine at the time, but now 3 months later, I can't really remember exactly what they said. And it's not really they haven't really given me like a tagline or a, you know, it's missing that creative zing.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
it seems like a challenge for all of us who work in this space where we're working with words and we're working through a process. And the process, there's a diligence to the process that you want to make sure you talk to the right people, that your sources of this idea are sound. So you do a really good job there. And then you've got to get to the next level where you take all the stuff and make something with it. Do you find that you need to bring others in to help you take it to somewhere? Or do you make it? Because the other feedback you get on good collaboration is great clients are good collaborators. So they actually get engaged in the process in a way that like a director would
Well, to answer your first point first, I think the words that you give clients are really important. Yeah. And it is beholden to us to make them interesting, sticky, memorable in the way that a creative idea would. Mm. So I do think that is a really, really important part of what we deliver. So it's not a sort of dry, dusty thing that sits on a shelf and no one can remember and no one uses. Mm. How we do that, I'd say we're pretty good at it, but there's always people that we'll collaborate with just to help us with those words to make sure they are expressed.
Yeah.
As
our closest and most frequent collaborator outside of one another is a creative writer. And so she works with us on almost all our projects and makes the words better. Mm-hmm. Now, she needs us to have got to a place and... You know, 9 times out of 10, she will then take our thinking and make it more memorable. And it's the thing that one of the things that we've learned more than anything, I guess, is that everything we do is about persuading people to believe in something. And in order to do that, you need great words. Mm-hmm. And when you're outside of the structure of an agency, you can do two things. So you don't need to worry anymore about whether or not what you've done is treading on the toes of the creatives. You can just be creative. And also you can choose to invite creative people to actually help you on your strategy without the project management director sitting there going, is this the best use of their hours? They've got 3 briefs, they've got to get some work out, da da da. And as I say, the creative we work with is a brilliant independent thinker, so she loves working with us, and you know, we can call on her services whenever we need them. And it means we get the words that can build the belief that makes strategy go further. And that's critical.
I think when you're in an agency and you're a strategist, it can make you a bit lazy because you're the intermediary delivering something on to the creatives. Whereas now we're delivering something straight to clients. So you have to make it exciting for them in a way that potentially you didn't have to in our old world.
It's interesting. Sometimes some of our projects we're working with the clients with an agency, right? So we take an idea, we work it with the clients, and then we brief an agency on it, and then we work through it. And in the strategy phase of that process that we're now seeing from the other side of the looking glass, you can sort of sometimes see the strategy person is like deliberately holding themselves back in order to not tread on the toes of the next department. And then you just spend weeks and weeks in this bizarre dance where the strategy person could often have done a lot more or come up with more things, but they're sort of almost like desperately trying to hold the line and not go too far into that creative process because they're worried about, I don't know, what the other department will think or whether or not they're allowed to. And it's weird because everybody should just contribute their creativity to make things better, but often strategists feel like they're not allowed.
Is that what you're finding? Because I did see a press release somewhere where it did say someone had started a campaign and you'd been involved in the strategy piece and it had been handed.
Yeah.
Is that increasingly what you're doing?
We've done quite a few like that for sure. We've got quite a range of different projects, but certainly there are now, I'm trying to think, what, 4 or 5 different things we've done that have resulted in campaigns or are just about to. Mm. And we've got a little side hustle in helping clients work out which agencies they might want to work with as well, but don't tell oyster catchers.
We have no incentive for doing it, just to be clear.
We're no.
Incentivized.
Well, the incentive is to make sure the ideas
exactly
come out really well.
But it's not a financial
incentive. No.
And in terms of the type of work you're doing, what's a kind of, obviously you talked about the sort of the big strategy, you know, somebody new comes in, wants a level set, wants to get this thing right for now. And that's sort of a, I would imagine, quite a big time, you know, potentially time consuming project. Other types of things that are less heavy lifting, is that you get involved in as well?
A little bit. I mean, I would say the core of what we do is brand ideas and putting ideas at the heart of brands that can then give them direction and clarity and help them be what they want to be in the world. And sometimes that results in advertising, often it doesn't. But that process you describe of speaking to loads of people, reading loads of things, looking at competitors, looking at markets and going, right, this is what you should stand for. That's probably the bulk of what we do. We've got two other things that we do a fair bit of then alongside that, one of which is kind of helping clients to make sense of all of the different offers they have, whether those be brands and sub-brands or propositions that have often sort of made their brands either a little unwieldy or a little confusing. So you might call it brand architecture. I'm not sure it's quite so clear cut as that. Often it's just about sorting out propositions and names and making things work more effectively. And then the other area we do a fair bit of is sort of making sense of things that they've been given by other agencies but don't know what to do with. So there's a few times when a client will be like, right, I've done some semiotics and it seems really clever, but I don't know what it means. And I've got these three research reports, all of which seem to point in slightly different directions. And I really don't have the time to go through them all in detail and then work out how to reconcile them against one another and what all this stuff should result in action. And again, we've done a fair bit of that as well. And I think that the core skill of simplification and strategic storytelling is really helpful across all those three disciplines. And I think that's pretty much the bulk of what we do.
I think we found that a lot of brands just accumulate things over time. Complexity of the story, as Craig said, complexity of how they present themselves with all their different brands and sub-brands. And a lot of what we do, I think, is just trying to strip away all those things and get back to the kind of heart and the core of what made that brand great.
Interesting organizations like doing interesting things, and intelligent people like to generate and create things, and people don't like to remove things because it feels less creative in an interesting way. And so much of what you're doing with brands, I think, nowadays is it's a sort of continual exercise in generation and then reduction and a sort of, okay, which of these things that we've invented do we really not need anymore? And which of these things are really kind of pointing the future? But it's a constant cycle of needing to kind of trim things back.
When we I think one of the interesting things when you go, you know, I think a lot of people talk about the problem with advertising strategy is it's advertising strategy, and strategy is bigger than that. And suddenly you've got sort of the opportunity to go upstream and you can focus on a sort of a bigger thing. And I think what I'm hearing when you talk to people who are involved in this is the challenges have become an organizational one, because you can have that great idea and you can have it beautifully articulated, but it then has to be implemented. And that's when it gets really hard. You're starting to talk to people who have separate sales and marketing and innovation group, and they never talk to each other.
Mm. And a large part of our job.
I was just saying that seems like a really interesting, you know, because whereas working at a high, you know, working as a strategist, as you guys did in one of the most creative agencies in the country, your output, your involvement in the output is very clear. It's sort of the progression is, you're not going to make an ad, you are going to do something. Whereas in this case, you're going to come up with a beautiful strategy, but whether it actually fully realizes itself, you have so little control over that. That seems to be the interesting challenge, you know.
You do, maybe, but I'm, you don't. I was just going to say a large part of what we do is enrolling the key internal stakeholders behind a brand idea. And if you can get them aligned and you can get them excited by it, you do maximize the chance of that thing staying with that organization and coming to life in a number of different ways at a number of different touch points. And I think it's underestimated how important that part of the process is, that we sort of think we deliver the idea and then you go over to you, and it's not that you really have to make sure that the right people understand it and embrace it and engage with it.
And I think sometimes I think what we've realized is it's a choice between doing something tangible that matters less or doing something intangible that matters much, much more. And I think from the ad agency point of view, and we used to fall into this fallacy ourselves, you'd sort of go, well, if you don't make an ad at the end of it, well, it wasn't worth doing. That thinking just doesn't exist. And you'd kind of go, oh, it only exists in the PowerPoint and in the charts. But once you're closer to the organization and you're more wired into their teams, as we often are, you can see much more the effect and impact that ideas have in organizations. And ultimately, ideas are ideas, and ideas are designed to influence people, influence behavior, the way they think. And the most powerful thing you can do is to put an idea at the heart of an organization that becomes self-propagating because people talk about it and people then act on it in loads and loads and loads of ways that have got nothing to do with making ads, but can change the way it works. We were with a client just yesterday, and they were recounting, someone from another department had come up to them and said, oh, I really like the Craig and Bridget work. And, you know, they'd seen some charts that had our logo on at the bottom, and it contained an idea that was just independently influencing them and what they were doing. And for us, that's much more exciting than having made a TV ad. You know, that may be a function of like having made lots of ads in the past and now got to this stage of our careers as well.
You've been there and done it.
Yeah.
So when you think about building a process, and obviously I don't want to steal your secrets or you to reveal your secrets, but there clearly seems to be, you know, just in the simplistic way, there's sort of the building of the idea and all the things that go into it. Then there's helping seed that idea and get the organization excited about it. And I could see that part of the business being quite considerable if you wanted it to be. I mean, I know consulting companies who that has become the main part of kind of what they do. Of making sure that idea is embraced and making sure that teams get it and doing all the things that you need to do to make sure teams get it. But then, you know, you have to decide where you want to focus, because you could easily get dragged into training.
I think we're very clear that our focus is on the creation of the idea, and we do bits of implementation in that we will often be taking ideas and presenting them on to other stakeholders within the organization. We certainly do that. We do that a fair bit. Mm-hmm. We don't really put much science and process behind that other than I guess the discipline that we've always had, which is to come up with ideas that are themselves kind of attractive and interesting and thought-provoking, and then those things tend to travel quite well. We don't put much science around it other than that, and our efforts, I don't know what you'd say, 70-80% of our effort is very much in the generation of the ideas, and we're trusting that good ideas will travel.
That seems to make sense. Are you encountering a bit of work with new companies like the startups of this world who seem to have started and know what they were doing and then sort of lose their way, or maybe just went into business and never really thought about their brand?
Very much so, and it's a joy either way, and equally very large organizations that have lost their way. The startups usually have a very passionate founder who had a really good idea and has focused all their attention on bringing that to life, but hasn't really worked out, as you say, what the brand around that is. And then sometimes they've done it for a few years and just slightly not done the thing that they should have done, which is articulate what exactly it is that they do.
We often meet them at their point of earliest professionalization, where they've just got a marketing person in. And most of these, most of the founder-driven organizations, they go through a period of like, there's three stages. Stage one is like the founder just does everything and there's nothing called marketing because everything is marketing. Then the founder realizes something called marketing, but it's so fucking easy they can do it themselves because like it's just coloring in. Then that often fails either because the founder is not great at marketing or doesn't actually have the time or bandwidth to do it, or they call in their mate who's not very good.
Yeah.
And then they'll realize they need to hire someone who knows what they're doing and they'll hire a marketing person in. And that's most often where we meet them, is that point where someone's gone, okay, we actually do need a bit of help with this now.
We have found something, I think, important, though. There has to be someone in that organization that can know what to do with whatever we provide them with. Yeah. That can be the founder, it can be their newly appointed marketing person, but someone internally has to be able to operate the machinery we give them. And it falls down if there's no one there that knows quite what to do with that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, I think what we see here is the performance marketing phenomenon. You know, where they're sort of the growth hackers. And they don't want to mention the B word. They don't want to talk about brands because they see that dollar going to something else that is not customer acquisition in their mind. And then so you kind of need them to evolve and say, yeah, this person's done a pretty good job. They've got us to a point. And it usually comes out in the numbers. They usually start plateauing. And then they're looking for the next thing.
And interestingly, the other place where so we've definitely seen that phenomena. The other thing that we've seen a lot of as well, where they suddenly realize they need people like us on occasion, is when they're sort of struggling to tell a compelling story to the next stage of investors. So, you know, they've got to a certain point, and I always forget the jargon, series one, series two, all that sort of stuff. But they're then in front of a very professional set of investors and they're trying to explain what they're all about, and they can do the nuts and bolts of the business. But sometimes the inspiring story about, you know, what they're offering the world just isn't there beyond optimizing performance marketing. And so actually, I think with a lot of those organizations, when we can help them put an idea at the heart of their business and brand, one of the biggest effects it can have is just helping them to unlock the right kind of investors at that point, even beyond whether or not they do anything in design or advertising or communication with the idea itself.
That makes a lot of sense. I'm gonna change tack a little bit and talk a little bit about this purpose. You know, brand purpose. Is that still around? Is it dying on the vine? Is it what's happening in your side of the Atlantic on purpose? Because it seems that it's coming under a lot of critical fire right now, and people are wondering how and why we got there in the first place.
It's certainly around, yeah. And I think there's an interesting, I don't know, it's a definitions thing, right? So the idea that brands should stand for something and have a core at their heart, which is an idea, not just a capability or a specialism, is probably, you know, more important than ever. And you could call that purpose. I think the bit of purpose which is also still there, but is rather different and indeed a little dispiriting a lot of the time, is when it's basically a sort of CSR bolt-on. And okay, we'll call it purpose, or when you get a brief and it just has that, it has that feel of it that the chief exec is maybe slightly embarrassed about how the company actually makes money, or when they're, I don't know, on the golf course with their other CEO mates and they seem to have a more purposeful reason in the world. Bridget calls it the everyone wants to go to heaven briefs that we sometimes get. Can't you just tell people how virtuous and wonderful we are, even though we actually make our money in a completely different way that we don't really want to talk about? And there's still a lot of that around. And it's sort of frustrating and annoying. We sometimes get those briefs. We often will work on them, but often what we try to do is pull it back to the core of how the company is actually making money and generating value, and trying to see if we can situate the meaning there. And then if you really want to do something which isn't just communicating where you actually create the value, that you've got some real action to back what you're doing. It's not the core of what we do. I wouldn't say we're the very best people to come to if you wanted really a CSR thing. There are other people that do that better. But as I say, when we get those conversations, we try and pull it back to the core of how the organization makes money.
And my worry a bit about it is we think it's brilliant that companies do the right thing and push on their sustainability agenda and their, you know, regeneration, whatever it is. But that's not always the same thing as wanting some sort of marketing activity or stunt or something. And I think they get conflated sometimes. And that's where I think it is slightly tricky.
Yeah, I think that a lot of people are talking about Cadbury winning an effectiveness award for generosity and not paying taxes.
Yeah, that's exactly.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And you know, and you can be happy about the fact that, you know, okay, well, it's just a clever way to persuade people that they should buy their chocolate. And that's fine because they're a commercial organization that has a, you know, set of shareholders to report to. But, or you can actually do some good, and that's fine as well. But kind of doing one thing and pretending it's the other is where it starts to get a little bit queasy, I think.
So, When you think about strategy and strategic ideas, when you think about like the longevity of them and how do you talk about that? Because we're in such a short term. We've got CMOs who are there for 18 months, you know, and everything's faster, and the world's changing. And I think there's a lot of commentary around sort of not trusting the future or not trusting our ability to see the future because, you know, it's just been proven time again. We could never have predicted A, B, C, or D. And people use that as a justification of like, well, we can't plan for the future. So how do you guys place strategy in a context where people are kind of not great at thinking about the future? It seems that's quite an important consideration these days.
Well, I guess part of what we do is try and not to build anything based on the prevailing narrative that's going on. Right. So as soon as you do a strategy that says, you know, coming out of COVID, people are feeling like this or whatever, it feels like a short-term answer to a problem. So we're very mindful that we're not just dealing with those sorts of reactions to things. And I think part of what we do quite often is be the voice of consistency. Mm-hmm. And so we, as Craig's already said, people love change. They love newness. They love excitement, especially in marketing. And I think part of what we do is just to keep reminding people what they've got and why they've got it and why it should carry on and why it works.
Yeah, it's back to that point you're making about fundamentals, right? You know, they lose sight of the fundamentals. I think it's interesting when, you know, the sort of strategy 101 brand archaeology, go and research why the hell the company started in the first place. And if you do something like Kellogg's, it's a fascinating history of what Mr. Kellogg wanted to actually do. But 100 years later, the company sort of lost sight of that and forgotten they even had a founder who had a vision.
And I think the other thing that we're always hugely conscious of, and we were talking about this just before we came onto the call actually, is the difference between business strategy and brand strategy, and how our work is all about making sure that the brand stands for a compelling idea that matches the strategy that the business is pursuing. And I feel like, again, if I go back to ad agency reminiscencing, a lot of the time they were wish strategies, like, you know, we'd come up with an amazing or amusing communications idea and then sort of go, let's pretend this is how that business makes money or what they're actually doing. And wouldn't it be better if they actually did this? And then you try and just assert it into meaning by creating an amusing advertising campaign about it. Whereas now we spend a lot more time sort of critiquing our own ideas by seeing how effectively they've taken the heart of where a business is planning to go over the next 5 or 10 years. And turn that into something that can connect emotionally with its audiences. And you have to grapple with reality. And I think if a business has a strategy, you know, something which it's going to continue to do consistently over the next 5 or 10 years. And then you support that with a brand approach that connects that strategy to people, then it kind of doesn't matter too much what's happening out there in the news agenda or what's happening, you know, what external shocks it gets. Because if the business is strategically good itself, it will adapt within its core strategic parameters to the short-term challenges it faces, because it knows who it is and what it wants to do. And it's quite rare for a business to like radically chuck away a long-term strategy because of a short-term shock. So if our brand strategy is aligned well to that, it should just continue.
100%.
Yeah, it's interesting because short-termism is just so rife, and it's so, I mean, you look at a brand like Peloton and, you know, you go, you know, it has to accept something, which was, it reached its zenith at a moment that will probably unlikely be repeated. But how do you assimilate that into the culture so they really understand that they're sort of building back from square one in a certain way? And yes, let's go back to those core truths of why they started in the first place. But that shock of the spike of massive success to contaminate the thinking and the culture. And, yeah. and it can exist for quite a while. Mm-hmm. So I know that's an extreme example, but you know, businesses are impacted by what happens in the now, and mm-hmm. you know, that is it's hard to unravel that. But I think I like the idea of the narrative being you've got to get back to something, a fundamental. Mm-hmm. Become all this other stuff has gotten in the way of who you really are. And when we went and spoke to X, Y, and Z, this is what we learned about who you really are.
Yes.
And who a business or an organization really is what they all say to one another on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. And often through conversation, we're able to understand that. Like, what are the stories that live in that organization about who they are? And then also what they do at scale. And you cannot get away from what are the main things we do, where do we mainly make our money, unless you're planning a massive, you know, growth pivot in some way and you're moving into a new area. But it's like that those fundamentals will always exist, and sometimes you have to do a bit of psychoanalysis or a bit of detective work to pull them out. But they're usually there. And that's the thing you've got to stare at and work with, not the, you know, whatever happens to be trendy this month or what happens to be on people's minds.
Yeah. I think that's right. And I think you're right. The language is get back to basics, but that doesn't mean literally find the thing. It means you might have to reinterpret it, re-express it, find new language to make sure it's relevant for now. Because it's a danger that sounds like you're just lifting from the past. You're not. You're sort of taking something and then finding a way to make
it for the present. Yeah, that's always the thing. And I think the thing that's interesting as well is, you know, when you have these conversations with these leadership, what surprises me often is you're looking for the red thread. You're looking for the consistency, but often there's confusion and there's an absolute lack of consistency. And so people think they're doing different things and in the world for different reasons, and forcing them to realize, you know, it's not an easy job.
Because when you do those discovery interviews,
you see that they are all over the place, and then you've got to take those people who are misaligned to a place where of common ground where they can nod their head and say, you know, you're right. So as you said, the persuasion part is quite important.
And it's interesting from our perspective, of course. You know, we have no aspirations to become McKinsey or Accenture or anything like that. You know, we're not doing business strategy, much as people kind of imagine you will be once you step outside of advertising agencies. We're really not doing that. There's a massive space still between business strategy and advertising, which is called brand strategy. But to a really important degree, if a business is fundamentally confused or conflicted about its own strategy, you can't do the brand strategy thing. It just can't be done. It doesn't work. Or it ends up being a bit of a lie. And those are the projects where you just think, okay, well, we can give them something,
but it's
never going to stick.
And I think also, to your point, we're storytellers. You have to take that group of people that might all start in different places through a story that gets them to, and this is where we'll lead you to. And that is a skill and an art, I think.
That's a bit analogous to the pitch process.
Yeah, for sure.
Persuasiveness in the argument, building the argument, and finding the evidence. But your output is obviously different. So, what would you? There are just so many strategists out there now freelancing. It's almost like there's no one inside of agencies anymore. What would your advice be? Would you advise this freelance army to work together more? What would you suggest? Because there's a lot of lone wolves, trying to pay the bills, and I just wonder if there's just almost too many people with strategy right now. But the supply exceeds the demand.
There's a lot of need for sure. And I think some of the advice I would give, I guess, is you have to be really honest with yourself about what you want to do, what you really like doing, what you're really good at or not, what your reputation is, if you have one or not. And then decide based on the answers to those questions, because I think you have to decide, do you want freedom or do you want security? You know, which of those two things do you prefer? And as I say, freedom and independence has a benefit and it also has some costs. And so does security. And I think some people never quite make that decision between the two, because I think certainly from what I've seen, a lot of freelance strategists who end up with a small number of clients and keep coming back to the one or two people they work with a lot might actually just be better off becoming marketing people and working in a brand strategy function in an organization. I think what we've been able to create is a business that has a vast amount of variety in it. I mean, we counted out the other day, I think we've worked with about 65 different clients since we started 2 years ago. Because we know we love variety and we never wanted to be in a position where we were hanging on to a few small clients, you know, and we've got clients we've worked with consistency through that period. But
we're better, aren't we? They benefit from the fact that we've been exposed to all sorts of different.
They benefit a great deal because of the experience of just looking at different problems. And the more problems you get, the better you get at it.
I think the problem for a lot of those strategy people you talk about is I think I see a lot of drift and a lot of sort of doing whatever work they can get and what comes up, as opposed to making a really deliberate decision about what you want to do, how you want to work, and then going out and getting that. And also not getting the other things that might come up. But I think making those decisions is both really quite hard because it requires a degree of self-knowledge and self-honesty. But it's also so important to be able to create a working life that you're going to enjoy. And I think that the demand for the function is really there. I think, is there enough demand for the freelance version of that function? I think that is the question, whether there's oversupply. And I think we never think about ourselves, and I know you weren't saying this, but we don't think about ourselves as freelance, really. I mean, we're an agency, basically. There's only two people in it, but we solve problems for people. One of the critical things we did, which is, again, I think we did instinctively, but was such a good decision, is everything we do is single fixed cost deliverable. We don't charge day rates. We don't quote days for projects. We take a brief and then we give someone a price to get to the end of that brief. And then it's up to us how many days it takes and how many collaborators we use or not, or how we get there. But it means we're only accountable to the outputs. And that means you don't ever get confused with that whole freelance hanging out with the marketing department, sort of trying to put an extra day in here or there, whatever. Your focus is entirely on ideas. And we did that because that's what we love. And it also makes our lives sort of better in a way, because you don't spend your time worrying about whether or not you've justified the number of days you sold to the client. You worry about whether or not the idea is worth the price you've charged them, which is a completely different thought process.
Yeah, that's the thing. I think you guys have done a lot of things right. I mean, you sort of built a brand in your own way, and you kind of clearly know who you are, and you have an identity, and you've done all the things that we tell people companies they should do themselves, and we're usually notoriously pretty bad at agencies and individuals at doing. I think there's a big challenge we have, which is we've always had, which is how do we know if what we've done is any good? I mean, whereas you can sort of judging work is relatively easy. Judging strategy is kind of like, yeah, I mean, you can tell what's not really good. There's sort of a big gray area of, so is that kind of okay? And then there's this tiny area of like, that's really brilliant. And, I'm sure the cadence falls around, you know, the individuals range along that gamut, but it's not commonly understood. There's not a common vernacular that says, you know, I think we know.
And I can tell you why we know, which is, I think there's a point at which you have to realize and understand that you have an expert customer. And I think in agencies, you're encouraged to believe that your customers are ignorant.
And will make the wrong decisions.
And they'll make the wrong decisions, yeah. And we're the only ones that know what good looks like. Well, once you realize that, no, you've got an expert customer, so the person who's sitting on the other end of the Zoom call or is on the other end of the table is really, really good at buying the thing that you're selling, yeah, and is a great collaborator, then it's good when they say it's good. And it's good when their eyes light up and they go, oh, I can use that. That's brilliant. I love that. That's when you know it's good. And how do you know before you present it to them? Well, it's because you've done, certainly in our case over the last couple of years, it's because you've done it like at least 65 times before. And every time you do it, you notice which things are working and which are working less well. And then you do the next one a little bit better as a result. But I think it's that point of realizing that you have an expert customer, not an ignorant customer, which is the big shift.
That's a great point, and I think that makes a lot of sense. But not every customer is an expert.
No, but many of the ones we work with are, and I think
maybe interesting process of how you decide who you're going to work with.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we talked about it the other day, where our process of both credentials and making proposals is basically designed to make sure that nobody works with us accidentally and that they know exactly what they're going to get. And if they don't understand what we're selling, then it's not for us to explain it. It means that they're probably not our best client.
Right.
And when they get it, and you know how much you need to show in order for them to get it, and then when they get it at that point, you know they're going to be good because they understand and they know what to do with it.
Yeah. And I think they require a bit of expertise and confidence to buy us, you know, because we're not a big known name for a lot of people. We're not a big agency that brings lots of people. So already I think they've made quite a confident decision, which is a good indicator, I think.
When we're in a process and it's kind of the two of us and we're up against, I don't know, for sake of argument, like a Wolf Ollins or something, and you've got the big sort of structure and the team and the brand name and that kind of thing. When a client's making a decision between us and someone like that, you kind of know that it's not quite right. And of course, you know, we have ended up in processes like that, and we have sometimes ended up being the person that's chosen and it's worked. But I think a lot of the time, it usually means that they're sort of trying us out, but they don't really have that confidence to go with it. And I think most of our best assignments are when people just come to us and say, can you do this?
And then another question related to the way you charge and structure is, when are you done? When is the job done? You're setting yourself up in the way you set yourself up, that may be quite iterative. Yeah.
This is our theme of the week, Ed.
Yeah.
This is our theme of the week. Yeah. It's like, how do we manage to say goodbye? And it's weird. It's one of the opposites of what we used to do, because back in ad agency world, it was like, no client is ever allowed to leave, and anyone who goes, it's a disaster, and we have to find a way to hold them. Whereas in our business, it's like, right, how can we move this to a point where we can then move on?
We often put the word final in presentations. So
in file names.
As a clue. And then Craig has got, every so often we'll say something like, so this is it.
Makes sense.
We're clear about deliverables as well at the beginning. So you can be fairly clear. Once you've got to the deliverable, there comes a point where you go, okay, we've done what we said we were going to do. We're really happy to do some more, and that'll be a new thing. But being clear about deliverables up front is part of the answer.
Okay, so this is going to be a weird 30,000 foot question, because we've been down the weeds. What do you guys feel? Are brands the same things that they always have been and were when you started in the business? Or are they fundamentally different now? It's a strange, and I don't know, a difficult question, but what do you guys think? Do you think we have brands are different things, and we have a different relationship? These generations, our generation around, have different relationships than they did 20 years ago.
My short answer is that brands are fundamentally the same, but how you might build them and how people will interact with them is really different. But the brand itself still is exactly the same that it's always been. Is that too glib an answer? How would you answer?
I think what you said is exactly right. I think the notion of what a brand is exactly the same as it was, but you can't do it in the same way you used to. And it's because there are now, I think, much greater communities of interest on both sides of that brand. So the people that are buying it, you know, will obviously subject it to greater scrutiny, will occasionally look up more about it, will occasionally play more of a part in its creation as an audience. But equally, and perhaps more importantly, the people who are working for that brand and working to create it are both people to whom that brand now owes a greater duty of care than they ever did. You know, how you're looking after the people that are employed, or the people who are in the supply chain. You know, that stuff matters a lot more than it used to. People care about it and should care about it much more than they did. And what I think it means is that, and I know it sounds kind of glib, but brands are increasingly better thought of as collections of people who are producing a thing than they are purely about things. And the fact that brands are collections of people comes back to the earlier insights we were talking about around fundamentally what we're doing is creating ideas that influence the behavior of many. But now many of those people are not the audience of the brand, they're the people who are creating it. And it's their actions we're choosing to influence. And perhaps in the old days, you could just tell them what to do, or you could control the expression of the brand much more tightly at the center. Now that's just not possible, nor even desirable, but it means you've got to put interesting ideas at the hearts of brands in order that the people who are creating them on a day-to-day basis both know what to do, but also feel motivated to do it really well. I think that's the fundamental difference that Bridge is alluding to when she talks about how you build them has to be different.
I think the other question that brings off that one is, it's never been easier than to create a brand than today.
Yeah. You know,
but is it a real brand? You know, what is it, what is a real brand versus a brand? Mm. And that's the something in, you know, anyone at home can set up a Squarespace account and create effectively a brand. Mm. But it's not going to be a resonant brand unless it has something to it. It's just and I think you're talking about the brands with some kind of pull and power.
Mm. It's about that there are about things which will somehow live independently in the minds of the people who touch them in some way.
Mm.
And again, you come back down to the weird thing we've had to go to, where we've had to two people's names have become a brand that now exists independent from us, but it does.
Mm.
You know, people will talk about, as I say, just that anecdote from just yesterday where people talk about the Craig and Bridget idea.
Mm.
And we were on a call with someone the other day when, you know, they were running some services for one of the organizations we had in a region of their operations. And they came on the call and they went, "Oh, you're actually called Craig. I thought you were from a trendy London agency that was called Craig and Bridget." And I was like, "Well, we kind of are, and we're also just Craig and Bridget, but both of those things are true." And I think, again, like for any brand, it's only really a brand if it represents an idea and a set of associations that will exist in people's minds independent of the people who've created it.
Yeah. All right. Any final words or final thoughts?
I don't think so. I think we've covered most of what we've got. I mean, I think I would encourage anyone to explore independence as a thing that is just great, with the caveat that we know that we were a lot more privileged in being able to do it because of the platform we had at the beginning. But I think if we were to go back and do things differently, I think we'd have probably done this a lot sooner.
Or at least deploy a bit more of an independent mindset. If you're still working in a big organization.
Exactly.
Like, if I went back, I'd be a different type of person.
Totally. Mm. Totally. The freedom that you have to think for yourself and to not worry about the constraints that are placed on you by a holding company or a broader set of organizations, and just thinking hard about the value you deliver. Again, I think there's probably too much once you're in the ecosystem of an agency. I think you take for granted the value of what you do too much. Whereas now, of course, we have to spend our whole time thinking, have we done anything that's really worthwhile?
Mm-hmm.
And I think you go back to agency world and you kind of go, well, you know, these damn clients, and they've paid for our agency and now they're not buying our ideas and they're all a bunch of idiots. And obviously what we're doing is of tremendous value because it took us days and we had to stay up late. And it's like, no, none of that is true. It's like, you've got to just keep on going. Am I doing anything of worth here or not? And sometimes the worth is hard to see, you know, sometimes it's intangible and it's ephemeral and it's ideas, right? But the ideas are the thing that matters, not what you make from them.
Final question, I've got one. You talked about freedom and independence, and I think it's kind of interesting that you see it quite a lot where, and I see it personally, that I have a very good idea of what a good work-life balance is, and I adhere to that strictly. Because I think the balance part of it is really important because it makes the work better. Mm-hmm. And I think people's kind of struggle with that when they're getting to the freelance world because they want to take every project on.
Yeah.
And end up being worse off
mm-hmm.
than they were prior because of that. What do you guys feel that you thrive on just keep taking on work and it's good? Or
We do, but you also have to know your own rhythms. So we're really much better in the mornings than we are in the late afternoons, evenings. So it's not that we take on a lot, but we know we'll be most productive at certain times of day. So we don't try and work, you know, 18-hour days to get it done. We use our time, I think, really effectively.
I think we've mastered now the art of doing less to do more, where we know that the fewer hours we work, the more work we do. Certainly the more good work we do, you know, and we rarely work beyond 5:30 on a weekday. Occasionally we have to do a bit of stuff at the weekend, but that's okay.
Yeah.
And we know that if you start pushing yourself beyond those hours, that you're just clocking up hours. And again, you go back to our charging model, clocking up hours is useless to us. Clocking up quality is the only thing we get paid for. And that's what you've got to focus on. And, you know, the quality comes from working fewer hours.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Thank you so much. This was an amazing, wonderful conversation. I learned a ton. I appreciate it.
Yeah. And my pleasure. Great thank you questions. For inviting us.
Yes.
I'll let you know when it gets posted.
Thank you.
Brilliant. Have a great day.
Thanks so much.